We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Our guests today on Focus have written a primer in progressive religious thought, a book called A House for Hope. I'm Steve Shoemaker, sitting in for David Inns today. Let me welcome by phone, first from the West Coast, Rebecca Ann Parker. Can you hear me all right?
I sure can, Steve. Thanks for having us.
And where exactly are you?
I am in Berkeley, California.
Berkeley at Star King School for Ministry.
Yes.
Where you are the president and a professor of theology. Welcome.
Thank you.
And on the East Coast, by the magic of radio, John Burens. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Steve.
And where exactly are you, John?
I'm at the First Parish in Needham, Massachusetts, an old congregation gathered back in 1711.
Rich place from reading in the book about it. I loved hearing some of the stories you told about what has happened in that parish over those 200 years.
It's an amazing place.
Now, you've both written this. You've written this book together, A House for Hope. Some of the chapters you wrote together, some you wrote separately on different themes. It's a fascinating book. I've really appreciated reading it. You subtitle it The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. Why was this book needed? Let's ask you, Rebecca, first.
We wrote this book in order to raise more loudly and publicly the voice of religious progressives of diverse faith traditions. Our perspectives and voice tends to be eclipsed when the public debates about religion are so focused on religious fundamentalists and conservatives. And we are part of, John and I are both part of long traditions of progressive religion that have a completely different worldview than the one that's dominating the religious news these days, and a very hopeful, promising, and important worldview for the issues we're facing right now as a nation and globally. So we want more people to be aware that there is an alternative and that there's a deep heritage of resource that can help us grapple with issues like the things that are most in the news right now, questions about taxation and the economy, questions about the environment, questions about international conflict between religions, on all these issues. There's a heritage of strength and hope and inclusiveness. We want people to know about it.
And John, what about you? What really motivated you to put in the time necessary to produce this good book?
Well, let me begin by saying that one of the reasons that we wrote the book with more than one voice, we wrote it in dialogue, is that that's essential to the tradition that we represent, to progressive religion. No one person gets the final declaration in our approach. It's always a deepening of a conversation. And Rebecca and I didn't agree on everything when we began this book, and we probably didn't agree about everything when we finished the book. But we deepened our mutual understanding of some of the profound issues that are going on in the world today. For me, one of the most important, of course, is the urgency of a religious response to the environmental crisis. You mentioned this old church that I serve. We're currently basking in some glow of just having been designated by the Environmental Protection Agency as one of their four annual award of merit congregations for the energy efficiency that we built into the place.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's they're going to actually hold a conference in our old building for houses of worship from all over the northeastern United States. We feel that this earth was given to us as a blessed but fragile creation that we're supposed to be good stewards of. And I think one of the most interesting chapters in the book is actually the two chapters at the beginning where we talk about responding to the environmental crisis, not out of despair, because that won't get us anywhere, but out of a realization that our spirits can be sustained by the beauty of what we already have and by the gratitude that teaches us that we have to treasure it and keep it whole. So much of what goes on in religious community, after all, is also trying to create the kind of beloved community that sustains the spirit, even when we are struggling for a justice that is not yet fully realized.
Now, you're mentioning the beloved community is familiar to those who know well the works of Martin Luther King, Jr. Tell us what you mean by that, or what King meant.
Well, I think King was trying to generalize the biblical language about the kingdom and to point out that what Jesus was preaching always was about the kingdom, the commonwealth of God being realized wherever we love the ground of our being with all of our hearts and souls, and where we love our neighbors as ourselves, and where we include everyone, where we don't make discrimination on the basis of race, gender, sexual orientation. The radical insight of progressive religion is often to see the image of God in people who have been denied the opportunity to fully realize their potential. Rebecca's school is deeply devoted to trying to help people uncover gifts that they have and then go out and encourage people minister in such a way that the gifts of others are allowed to more fully flourish in the world.
The concern for ecology that you mentioned in your congregation's recent building project makes me think of something said by someone I read recently, that God is so tender, sometimes she is called green.
Yes.
And, of course, I'm quoting from Rebecca Parker. Rebecca, would you like to comment on that?
Well, that phrase is, God is so tender, sometimes she is called green, is a phrase in our book, A House for Hope, and it comes from a dream I had in which I was struggling with how strongly the heritage of how frequently religion imagines God in exclusively male terms and as distant from the world and all-powerful and all-knowing. And the progressive religious tradition and progressive Christianity brings forward some other elements of God's nature and balances that out with a sense of God as also, we can even say, vulnerable to the impacts of human choices, and so that we can... So the sense of God is so tender, sometimes she is called green, the message of that dream and that phrase is that we have to understand the sacred interdependence of all life, the greenness of life, the way that life comes in through the earth itself, as something that can be violated or destroyed if we are not respectful of the tenderness of the world and the tenderness of one another. So hubris is when we think we are all-powerful, and if we imagine God is all-powerful, then we justify our sense that we are all-powerful. We need humility in life. Of course, the word humility comes from the word humus, the earth. We need to know, like the wonderful feminist Susan Griffin says, we are made from this earth. You have this in Buddhist teachings as well, this affirmation that we are living in illusion if we think that there's an independent I that exists apart from our dependence on all of life and all of each other. So this religious and spiritual affirmation of our interdependence, in which we have both responsibility and vulnerability, we need this worldview, this spirituality, in order to do right by each other and face the kinds of and redress the kinds of consequences that are happening to the globe and to our human relationships because we are lacking in humility, respect, and reverence for this life here and now.
In that same chapter in this book, A House for Hope, that's incidentally published by Beacon Press just out this year, you also remind us of the Reimagining Conference, which religious people joined together. I hadn't realized it was 20 years ago now, back in 1990, but you talk about the intense antagonism to that gathering of progressive religious people that came from the religious right, particularly the Christian religious right. Tell us how I presume, Rebecca, you were at that conference.
I was at that conference.
And probably one of the leaders. But tell us who were not able to be there, or what difference that made in over the last 20 years.
Well, the Reimagining Conference that brought so much fire from the religious right was a conference that lifted up the voices and leadership and theological perspectives of women of color from all around the world. And what women of color were raising in their religious commitments was profoundly opposed by some of the religious right. But those perspectives there's been tremendous, beautiful new work done in theology and religion over the last 20 years because the doors of religious scholarship have been opened to women. Actually, maybe we should say women have opened those doors and moved through them. And one of those scholars who was in leadership at the Reimagining Conference in 1990 is my good friend and co-author on another project, Rita Nakashima Brock. And what I can report is the women, though there was a backlash from the religious right, women lost their jobs in denominational settings for that. And the women who were in leadership then have been wonderfully persistent and creative and active for all these decades. But the backlash to progressive religion is going on right now in an incredibly intense way, again, with the ways that the values of progressive religion are being questioned and opposed in the public sphere, the acceptance of same-sex relationships, the care for the environment, opposition to war, advocacy of social networks that support life. The kind of rhetoric we've got going on from the religious right and the political right now is pushing against all of those affirmations. So part of what John Burns and I are doing in House for Hope is saying, hey, we're here. We are here with this alternative vision. We've been here. We're doing creative work. We're doing deep work. We're doing persistent work. But in House for Hope, we lift up some of the ways in which progressive religion is an alternative to religious claims that are, in our judgment, causing harm in this world.
You quote from many different people in your book, from many different religious and secular traditions who are part of this progressive movement that you describe so well in your book, A House for Hope. We've already mentioned Martin Luther King. You go so far into philosophy as Alfred North Whitehead. You quote the Muslim Persian poet Rumi, Augustine, Martin Buber, Thich Nhat Hanh, Paul Tillich, Eboo Patel, who was a Muslim, who was a guest on this Focus program just last Monday, by the way. You quote from this wide variety of sources, and yet both of you come from Unitarian Universalist tradition, although, Rebecca, you're also a ordained United Methodist minister.
Okay.
Tell us how the Unitarian Universalists can be so open to so many many religious traditions.
Well, I think we've often seen in our tradition a need to be the catalyst of deeper conversation. The oldest international interfaith organization in the world was founded by Unitarians back after the Chicago World's Fair in the 1890s. I had the honor for a number of years of serving as honorary president of the World Conference on Religion and Peace, which is an organization that's supported by the Vatican and the Muslim World League and the World Council of Churches, and is arguably one of the most effective interfaith leadership organizations in the world. There are grounds in every religious tradition for the kind of progressive outlook, the tolerance, the dialogue that we're trying to promote. All too often, however, what happens in the world is that we stereotype the other. We bear false witness against our religious neighbor. This is happening tremendously about Islam these days in the United States with the Islamophobia that has been fanned for political reasons, in my view. By the way, here in the United States, moderate, liberal, and progressive denominations have often been targeted by secular political conservative forces with money trying to divide them and silence them. And I think one of the things that provoked Rebecca and myself to write this book is in part to blow the whistle on that. Many denominations have had it with people trying to manipulate them and keep them from speaking out of conscience, keep us from deepening the conversation. To a large degree, of course, the media foment the sort of the talking head fight between conservative equals religious conservative and liberal these days often is some individualistic libertarian, when the bulk of America's religious people, like ourselves, are people who care deeply about the common good and who draw on spiritual and religious tradition in order to promote the common good.
Rebecca Parker is co-author with John Burins of this new book out, 2010, A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. I'm Steve Shoemaker, host for this program of Focus Today. Let me remind listeners, this is a live program that you can participate with by calling in with questions or comments. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, punch in 333-9455. If it's long distance, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And that includes anybody in the continental U.S. who's listening online at will. let's see, I have to stop and think again. At will.illinois.edu. There you go. And you can can call us on our toll-free number. Again, that's 1-800-222-9455. The reason I was confused about the website is I'm also trying to remember that you can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. So, happy to have people call in, eager to have this conversation expanded, and our two guests will respond to your questions or comments. Let's talk about how you opened the book. You say hope is rising. Now, you wrote this book, I'm guessing, what, 18 months ago? Maybe you finished
when
it, or 12
when
months.
Hope is, rising.
Is hope still rising, of course, is the question.
Well, one has to admit that the public mood these days is, I think, split between anger and depression. And all the more reason then that the spiritual leaders should keep a steady focus on hope. I think one of the things that we determined in our dialogue with one another is that all too often hope gets focused on particular political outcomes, particular leaders, things that will not bear the full weight of all of our spiritual aspirations and hopes. And that's why the theological dimension opens up. Our hopes have to have something of a transcendent openness to them in order to be real. Otherwise, they attach themselves to objects that, well, the prophet Zechariah at one point talks about people who have become prisoners of hope because they have focused on things that are too small to bear the full weight of their spiritual yearnings.
Comment, Rebecca?
I'm captivated by that phrase, prisoners of hope. I've forgotten that about Zechariah, John. Thanks for that reminder. A prisoner of hope is easily disappointed when the specific object is not attained. But the kind of rising hope, in some ways, I think of that image of rising hope the way a tide rises, the way water rises and flows. I come from the Pacific Northwest where the Puget Sound tides come in and out, but the rising of the tide, I think that the kind of rising of the tide that we experienced politically around the election of Obama represents the emergence of a set of sensibilities among people that is a very important rising sensibility, even if it's not manifested, even if it can't be fulfilled just through a political process. And the things I saw in that and affirm in that rising tide are, and I see this especially among young people, a really deep sensibility of interdependence. And this is one world, one globe. We're connected to each other, and we have to live out that connectedness in responsible and life-giving ways. And also an affirmation of cultural interchange and complex identities. I think one of the things so interesting about Obama is how, on whom hope is focused, even though Obama has persistently said, this is not about me, and tried to give it back to the people. It's like, this is about us, about you, and it's about all of us. But Obama's own identity, so marvelously complex, with roots in different places around the globe, as well as deep roots in the U.S. culture and traditions. And we have young people now. This is a rising sense that many of us have a heritage that brings different races, ethnicities, even different religions together in one life. And this tapestry of mixity or interconnectedness or interweaving of culture and tradition, that's a sensibility that's very fresh. And at our school, where I work with young adults who are committing their life to religious leadership for social change, this is the sensibility, the spirituality that they are bringing to their devotion to making a positive difference in the world. And I take great hope in this affirmation of connectedness, interdependence, creative interchange.
I think in every culture there are people who react to that interpenetration of cultures and the complexity of the modern world with fear. And frankly, we call them neo-fundamentalists. And they begin to mobilize the identities of the more traditional and anxious members of their society in often violent opposition to the very thing that gives Rebecca and myself hope. I think one of the things that justifies our hope is that we're really quite convinced that this neo-fundamentalism in each religious tradition is a small minority phenomenon that has been given undue weight, partly because it so often resorts to violent solutions and negativity, and therefore makes the news. While the bulk of America's people and the bulk of religious people around the world are leading lives of dialogue, compassion, an attempt to give back to the rich heritage,
and of course tolerance.
Yes, exactly. So I think hope is bigger than the fear that gets so much attention.
In your book, you have various chapters dealing with some of the fundamental traditional categories of Christian theology. You start with what for me was a surprising place, what you call progressive eschatologies, thinking about the end times. Why did you pick that, Rebecca?
We start with progressive eschatologies because so much of what's going on in the religious right, because we're speaking in dialogue or in response to the religious right, is an eschatology, a view about the end of time, that imagines that God is going to destroy this world and create a new world, and that a few faithful people, the right people, are going to be raptured into the next world. This worldview is incredibly popular, and it's present in books like the Left Behind series and films, and it supports and connects to movements that disregard this earth and the environment as sacred. Or if you believe that God is going to destroy this world, there's no need to take care of this world. We just wait for the next world. We've even had people in political power setting public policy who have this view. And it's a very dangerous view because it allows things like we've just seen this summer in the ongoing tragedy in the Gulf ways of extracting oil from the earth that put whole huge ecosystems and economic systems at risk. People willing to hurt the earth because their religion tells them that God is willing to hurt the earth. That is a powerful, terrible idea. It's bad theology. And we wanted to start with the alternative that and lift up something that is, affirms the goodness of this earth and our responsibility to it.
We have a caller waiting on line number 4, a caller from Bloomington, Illinois.
Yeah, thank you for this program. I'm anxious to read the book. I read Tom Hartman's The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Are you familiar with that book? He covers much of the same material. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can
hear
you.
But I'm afraid I don't recognize the title. Do you, Rebecca?
No. But thanks for a recommendation of a good book. I always like to hear that.
It's excellent. And he has one of his recommendations is giving women more power. I hate to word it that way, but, you know, in legislation. And then I was wondering, I have two questions. Well, maybe three. The Bioneers, are you familiar with the Bioneers? Deep ecology.
Yes, indeed.
I think they have done wonderful work. But do you? How? I really love everything you're saying, but I'm wondering how realistic is our wish to really correct things. I mean, it's just over the centuries, it's just getting worse and worse. And the other thing, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that it's not bad theology. It's not theology. It's just a quest for power using theology.
That would be my definition of bad theology.
Yes, exactly.
A quest for power. A quest for power that uses theology.
Well, thank you very much for those questions. Let's give our guests John Burns and Rebecca Parker, the authors of House for Hope, opportunity to respond to those. First, how realistic is it to hope given the pessimism?
Well, I don't accept the idea that everything is getting worse. I grew up in the Midwest along the Great Lakes, along the shore of Lake Erie, in a time when, as a kid, I couldn't go swimming in the lake because it was so filthy and polluted. My younger brother worked very hard on the cleanup of Boston Harbor. It takes effort. I went to see my new U.S. Senator, Scott Brown, not long ago, about climate change and environmental things, along with a very large interreligious delegation. One of the things that we had to say to him is, we may have to tax ourselves, actually, the way we did for the cleanup of Boston Harbor by raising our water and sewage rates in order to keep the planet from overheating. But, let's do it. We can do this. If we assume at the beginning that everything is going to get worse, it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think what people need desperately is support both from their political and spiritual leaders to say that there are some things that we are really being beckoned to do by all that is holy in every tradition, but that we can do, we have the capacity to do. And our hope lies in that, in our ability to respond responsibly.
And before we have Rebecca respond, I'll say something from the Midwest perspective here in the state of Illinois, which has some huge financial problems. Like the state of California, there are still progressive people, such as Protestants for the Common Good, which is lobbying here in Illinois for a modest but realistic tax raise that might help us continue to fund social services and support education. So there are progressive voices, even politically, that are making that same kind of response. Rebecca, from your thoughts?
My comment on the question, how realistic is our wish to correct things that the caller posed, I think we need to say loud and clear that what is unrealistic is the expectation that we can continue to abuse the Earth's resources and expect life to be sustainable on the planet. What's unrealistic is the way the dominant culture is, and the reactionary culture right now is trying to sustain a way of life and a worldview that is so out of touch with what is real, with how life actually is sustained. So I'm in favor of realism, and part of my critique of what's so problematic about the religious and political right is it is so profoundly unrealistic. It is so profoundly out of touch with what is required of us to live together with abundant life for all people and justice for all people. And that's the unrealism that I think we need to be speaking about.
I agree with that. I think that there are powers and principalities, as the scripture says, that we have to uncover and deal with and identify. Many people, in the financial collapse, came to realize that unfettered capital markets have inherent exploitative dangers that feed speculation and cost jobs, and these things need to be supervised by adults. There needs to be a fair amount of government regulation in order that our market economy can function fairly. Religion, actually, in my view, in many civilizations, came to birth when people started trading with one another and started seeing that their different customs, their different ways of measuring money and goods and the like, all needed to be brought to bear under a common sense that one should treat the other the way one would like to be treated. That's the origins of the high religions in each of our civilizations.
And you have a very strong chapter in your book on evil, on the evils of our present day that need to be confronted by progressive people. We're a little over halfway through our program here on WILL AM 580. This Focus program is dealing with a very provocative recent book, A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century, by John Burens and Rebecca Ann Parker, published by Beacon. John Burens is a recent president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and now minister of the First Parish Church in his very historic church in Needham, Massachusetts. Rebecca Parker is president, professor of theology at Star King School for Ministry in Berkeley, California. We're talking with them both by phone. Let me remind listeners, we are eager to have your thoughts and comments and questions. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free number if you're listening at will.illinois.edu. If you want to send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk a little bit. We talked just a very short time about your first chapter, Eschatology. Let's jump quickly to thought about God. There are many secular progressives, but you make a strong case that progressives who have a religious background, whether it's Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Protestant, Catholic, whatever, mm-hmm. really are supported by communities. Tell us about your views of God.
Well, I think this is an area where Rebecca and I actually have a fair amount of common ground. One of the things that we think many progressive people have forgotten is that a lot of their values really have been shaped by religious institutions and upbringings. What has often died for them is what might be called the old God, sort of the white guy in the sky controlling everything. That image of God has been appropriately critiqued in liberal and progressive theology for quite some time. What we want to do is to say that once you have deconstructed the problems that go with the all-controlling, male-imaged, supernatural God, that doesn't end theological reflection. There is still the fact that we are blessed to be part of a process that is so cosmic and so big and so beautiful that we can't quite name it. Maybe some people will say we don't need to name it. But for Rebecca and for myself, it is what is sacred. It is what we bow down in humility before when we say the word God.
Rebecca, at one point, I think it was in one of your parts of a chapter where you said, God is not our biggest threat. What did you mean by that?
I don't remember saying that, so you have to remind me. I'm sure you're right that I said that, but I have to recall what the context was.
It may have been John.
Maybe it may have been in the context of your discussing how many images of God we have had to critique.
Yes, and I do think let me say this. That
you say we don't need to be saved from the danger that God will eternally punish us for our sins. Mm-hmm. The tragic consequences of sin are of our making. God is not our biggest threat.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
That sounds pretty good to me.
I liked it too.
You reminded me. Yes, this is part of a progressive Christianity's understanding of sin. And it goes back to one of the early social gospel theologians who John and I discuss and affirm, Walter Rauschenbusch, who emphasized that when we frame our religion as if God were the divine lawgiver, and if we don't obey God's laws, God is going to punish us, then we turn our attention away from the fact that that sin actually, the consequences of sin is what it does to each other and to the earth. So that we have to actually recognize that the consequences of our unjust acts, our thoughtlessness, our greed, are the harming of our interdependent relationships with one another and the full flourishing of all life. So the danger is of life is not that God is going to punish us for disobeying as if we were bad children. And imagining God that way is not very helpful. It's distracting.
Well, it keeps us childish.
It keeps us childish, and that what we really need is to understand God as the one who accompanies us in this life and calls us to reverence one another, ourselves, and the earth, and live rightly with each other. God is the one at work within us and among us, urging us and offering us the grace to repair the world and our relationships when we have screwed up. And that this is, rather than fear of punishment, if we're going to have any fear at all, it should be fear that we're going to harm each other and the world.
Let me interrupt because we do have a caller waiting on a cell phone. Line number 4 for a caller from Tuscola, Illinois. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. Enjoying the conversation quite a bit. Just a couple of, observations, which I'll throw out for your guests maybe to comment on. But a couple of interesting things, I hope. I was raised Roman Catholic in Chicago, and we moved a few years ago down to a small rural community in Illinois. We have two children, a 10 and a 15-year-old. And we made the jump to becoming a Presbyterian, which is something I never thought we would have done. But the minister and his wife were very, very good with kids, and that was really what drove our decision. But in reading up on it, very interesting statistics that current body of faith that make up Presbyterians, 55% of those individuals actually came from a different religion. So when I was raised, it was very dogmatic. A lot of what you're talking about, punishment, as a child, you're waiting to go to confession when you're 8 years old, wondering, what did I do? And it was really, it was a fearful God. It was a menacing God. And I think when people get older and they can step back and really make up their own minds as to the faith they want to follow, but really the differences are minutia, really, if you think about it. But the question I had for comment was about a week or so ago, there was a news article that came out that Stephen Hawking made a comment where the beginning of the world, if you will, actually came about on its own volition. And in essence, he made the hypothesis, I guess, that actually there was no need for God. And I was wondering if your guests had any comments on that provocative statement, and I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, I think the caller has identified one of the big changes that's taken place in American society since I was born in 1947. In that year, shortly after World War II, studies showed that only about 5% of religiously active people in the United States were active in a religious community other than the brand or denomination in which they had been raised. But by 1995, religiously active people in the United States, 45% had made a conscious choice as an adult about what religious community fit them. And that, I think, is indicative of people really thinking a little bit more deeply about where they belong and going beyond the bounds of particular ethnically related groups and the like. And that's all to the good. Now, about Stephen Hawking, I think I would say this. At the end of his often unread book, A History of Time, Dr. Hawking left open the possibility that the explanation for there being something rather than nothing could be called God. In his latest book, I'm a little bit puzzled. I wonder whether this is more his new co-author. Of course, what he's saying is that his latest iteration of some of the laws of physics indicates that something like the concentration of all things into a tight mass and then its explosion in a big bang could be predicted from the laws of gravity. But why this can't be seen as a divine event, creative in its character, and indicative of a mysterious creation that is worthy of reverence, I don't understand. He could further enlighten me. There's a tremendous tendency these days for the new atheists to be reacting against the old God and not to pay attention to what more progressive theologians are saying and doing in dialogue with science.
We're down to our last 5 or 6 minutes of this Focus program with our guests, John Burens and Rebecca Ann Parker, author of A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century, published by Beacon. I'm Steve Shoemaker, guest host for Focus Today. I found out just earlier this morning that this book will be the subject for a discussion class at the local Unitarian Universalist Church here in Urbana. That's at 309 West Green Street, and there'll be 7 sessions. One has already happened discussing this book, but I talked to the pastor there by email, and he assures me it's available for others to join in even now. It'll be meeting the first and third Thursday of each month and be led by Pastor Axel Gehrman, who's been a guest on this program previously. If you want to find out more information about it, you may call the church, 384-8862. That's in the 217 area code, or go to their website, uucuc.org. That's a discussion of A House of Hope in Urbana, Illinois. We have lots of people waiting on the phone. Let's see where we should go first. Let's go to Chicago, line number 4. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Oh, yes, I'm Catholic, and I wanted to ask a question about the danger of moral relativism. The Pope has talked about this, and even though the Catholic Church would agree with a lot of the issues such as economic justice, the Pope has also spoken about this danger that, you know, any type of behavior is acceptable these days, and I think that's one of the dangers of progressive theology, where, you know, you recognize different behaviors, and it's tolerable, and I'd just like to know your opinion on that.
Thanks for the question.
Well, I think Rebecca and I both take the position that absolutizing behavioral standards with regard to human sexuality often gets in the way of love. And we're disinclined to do that, wouldn't you say, Rebecca?
Yes, but I would, yes, and this is not a or, but and, if the notion that any type of behavior is acceptable as a characterization of progressive religion is not a characterization I would accept. I certainly do not feel any type of behavior is acceptable, that anything goes. That, I mean, I come from a long line of very progressive Christians. Anybody who thinks that's what progressive Christianity is has not met my mother or my grandmother. We were trained and raised with a very strong moral and ethical sense. So what is characterized as moral relativism is an inaccurate characterization of progressive religion.
And I serve as the national co-chair of Freedom to Marry. When I started with that movement, I was one of the few straight allies working with gay lesbian people. But I do that out of profound concern that gay and lesbian people be allowed to lead lives of deep commitment, compassion, integrity. I have gay lesbian couples in my congregation who are raising children beautifully. And, you know, to deny them their dignity strikes me as we're not talking moral relativism here. We're talking about the opportunity for them to lead supported lives of moral integrity.
We'll go to another caller, another line, this time on line number one from Chicago. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, you're on Focus.
Thank you. In response to the caller about Stephen Hawking's book, there are other scientists and physicists who are doing a different math, and they definitely say they can prove the existence of God, for that matter. But to another more earthly dimension, I think Stephen Brand and others way back when the Earth Day movements were beginning, began to recognize and still those who became part of the Green Party and other people become conscious of the environment, about the sacredness of the Earth and to the extent that we can regard it rather than trample it and waste it and spoil it and realize this is an oasis in the vast universe, at least for us here now. And but the whole aspect that you're talking about has been so wonderful and open. It's like a rainbow of viewpoints that are all together and keep out right on this, and looking for the part at the end of the rainbow, and maybe we'll find it. Bye.
Thank you very much for that positive response. Any quick response from our guest today before we go to our maybe a last caller?
Well, let's get the last caller.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go to line number two in Champaign, Illinois. You're on the air.
Is that me?
Yes.
As the son of a minister who left the church because he was he was more concerned about moral code than he was concerned about godliness, I have to say that I've just been to a prayer conference, and the education seems to be a major, major factor. One of the comments from Land Trust people was that there are people out there who want to do some of these things and look at complex ecosystems, and we have to be very willing to take those people in hand and to educate them, because they can't possibly know about the ecosystems that they're trying to preserve, and we have to give them that sort of resource. And I applaud the community colleges and those groups of people who are doing educational work behind the religious aspects of things.
Thank you for that comment. Why don't we let president of an educational institution, Rebecca Parker, respond.
Thank you. I'm very moved by what you just said, and it touches right for me on the heart of my religious commitment and devotion, which is a commitment actually to be intimately observant and wise about this world. To love life is to know it, and to learn to love this world involves and requires really being present to it. And as a small child, I used to walk with my grandmother, progressive Christian, along the road, and she would teach me to observe every one of the plants that was there, and the distinctiveness of the way the members of the mint family have square stems, and when the cow parsnips came up, I learned all the names of the plants and the birds and the animals right in that local environment. To me, that was the essence of Christianity, is to consider the lilies of the field and the birds of the air and to look closely at this life. I submit that nobody who has looked closely at the square stems of the mint plants can conceive of destroying the environment. So to know is to love. Thank you for what you said. And about how important education is.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I do want to thank very much our two authors, John Burens, former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and currently minister of the First Parish Church in Needham, Massachusetts, co-author of other books with Forest Church, A Chosen Faith and Understanding the Bible. Our second guest, Rebecca Ann Parker, president, professor of theology at Stark King School for Ministry in Berkeley, California, also co-author with Rita Nakashima Brock of previous book, Saving Paradise and Proverbs of Ashes. She's also an ordained United Methodist minister. She has dual fellowship with the Methodist Church and the Unitarian Universalist Association. As you've heard, they are the authors of a new book, A House for Hope, which I've appreciated very much. It's the promise, talking about the promise of progressive religion for the 21st century. Many important themes are in that book that we weren't able to get to in our 50 minutes today, but I recommend it for people to read. Supporting focus today has been the University YMCA, where Robert McChesney will be speaking tomorrow at noon at the University of Illinois Y. He's professor of the Department of Communication and host for Media Matters here on WILL at 580 a.m. on Sundays. He'll be speaking at noon this Friday at the University YMCA. Thanks for listening.